Inposts of Empire, a five-part talk. Introduction. I began this talk fully expecting that we would meet face-to-face in June, that we would shake hands and embrace, sit side-by-side in tight-packed rooms, ride elevators together, and maybe poke around the city at odd hours, jostling with the crowds of tourists who had come to New Orleans strictly for fun. I did not know this talk would end up as a requiem for the conference we lost, the words never spoken, the colleagues never applauded, and those we will never see again. This requiem took shape in a time of collective insecurity, as microscopic virions traveled by air and touch, revealing in their rapid spread the planetary felting of human interconnection. Yet if this talk is an artifact of a traumatic time, it is equally an artifact of place. It took form in a noisy house teeming with displaced children, everyone squabbling over bandwidth, fretting about toilet paper, padding around in the pre-dawn hours, and listening to the sirens outside. If my remarks seem out of place, recall that this talk came together in the middle of a globe-spanning crisis that played out spatially in my life, and indeed in the daily lives of the countless millions of people around the world affected by travel bans, social distancing guidelines, quarantines, orders to shelter in place, unemployment, protests, curfews, and a mobilizing illness. If you have a hard time locating this talk in the larger landscape of U.S. foreign relations history, recall this scene, a networked globe struggling to go local to break the circuits of contagion. If this talk is a requiem and artifact, it is also an escape. People in lockdown have ached for the outside world, connecting virtually in many cases to distant relatives and friends, and imagining the journeys they will take on the other side. I hope in this talk to respond to the need for community and unfamiliar lines of sight by taking you to New Orleans after all, if only imaginatively. But be forewarned, this is not a typical touristic tour. As a Schaefer-sponsored tour, it is a journey across time as well as space. And be assured, as a Schaefer-sponsored tour, the ultimate destination is the foreign relations field, with New Orleans illustrating the idea of an inpost of empire. To embark, picture yourself in a hotel ballroom, sitting elbow to elbow with your neighbors, the forced air cooling taking the edge off a sticky June day, the tinkle of dishes being cleared, the AV activated, an introduction, a clearing of the throat, a small cough. In this virtual world, no one flinches. Can you hear me in the back? Part 1, Land Acknowledgement. I would like to begin by acknowledging the indigenous history of New Orleans, and more broadly, Louisiana, and recognizing the Chittimacha tribe of Louisiana, the Coushatta tribe of Louisiana, the Jenna band of Choctaw Indians, and the Tunica-Biloxi Indian tribe of Louisiana. I would also like to acknowledge the state-recognized tribes of Louisiana, which include the Adai-Caddo tribe, the Biloxi-Chittimacha Confederation of Muscogee, Choctaw Apache Community of Ebarb, Clifton Choctaw, Four Winds Tribe Louisiana Cherokee Confederacy, Grand Cayou Duloc Band, Isle de Jean Charles Band, Louisiana Choctaw Tribe, Pointe aux Chenes Indian Tribe, and the United Houma Nation. As this acknowledgement reminds us, the indigenous presence where we now gather predates the city of New Orleans. Indeed, it predates the land on which the city rests. A mere 5,000 years ago, the place where we are gathered lay under the waters of the Gulf. 500 years ago, the surrounding area was largely swamp, an ever-changing mix of solid and fluid, water, spongy stuff, and land. The indigenous nations of this area have been water people as well as land people, their claims to place and space encompassing both the solid and the aqueous. The land on which we gather has been utterly transformed by settler colonialism, shot through with girders, dried out by drainage ditches and canals, solidified by tons of oyster shells in the absence of other paving materials, and walled in by levees. One-time marshes in Louisiana have spontaneously ignited in the summer heat as escaping methane has exited through the cracks in what is now parched ground, the hellish fires an unforeseen consequence of draining the swamp. As settler colonists transformed muck into firmament, they also transformed water, on an unprecedented scale, altering salinity, particulate matter, levels of toxins, and biota. The South American water hyacinth, introduced in the 1880s for ornament, has run renegade, crowding out native plant and animal species. The nutria, a gnawing muskrat introduced from South America to control the hyacinth, has exacerbated the damage to cypress forests caused by flooding and saltwater intrusion. The fire ants, also from South America, that have decimated ground nesting species, float atop the rising waters in writhing rafts, their venom intensified by stress. The waters are definitely rising. The National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration predicts that southeast Louisiana will be inundated by 4 to 5 feet of rising seawater by the end of the century, more than any other part of the U.S. coastline, and indeed the highest rate of sea level rise on the planet, because the sediment-starved delta is sinking. Predictive maps show that Louisiana will no longer look like a boot. Within a century, the coastline will run east to west on a line to the north of New Orleans that will cut across the state near Baton Rouge. If predictions are borne out, by 2050, 1% of the world's climate refugees will hail from Louisiana. The swelling seas are already eating away at the Louisiana coast, pushing residents such as the Isle de Jean Charles Band of the Biloxi Chitimacha Choctaw tribe into active retreat. Tribal citizen Chantel Cormerdell described the unfolding crisis to a reporter from The Guardian. "There used to be land on either side of the road, and now it's just open water. Everyone used to have gardens, and now they don't. The salt water kills everything." The Isle de Jean Charles villagers are not the only indigenous people suffering from this latest assault on indigenous territory. Members of Louisiana's United Houma Nation can no longer recognize the shoreline upon returning from fishing trips. Of the acre of land that coastal Louisiana loses to the Gulf each hour, at least a half comes from the Barataria-Terrebonne estuary, where the majority of the Houma people live. Land losses stemming from settler colonialism are not just an artifact of the past. They continue today in new ways. If the precarious nature of land in present-day Louisiana is a reminder of the ways that global affairs have literally and profoundly constituted place, acknowledging the indigenous people of Louisiana reminds us that global affairs have been of existential importance for the peoples of this place since before the emergence of the United States. We have gathered in a corner of what historians of the early modern world have labeled the Shatter Zone, a place where long histories of cross-group indigenous encounters that predate the arrival of European and African peoples turned magnitudes more deadly in the 16th century, leading to the collapse of chiefdoms such as the Chickasaw and the coalescence of new polities such as the Choctaw and the Chickasaw. Taking a long view perspective makes visible what shorter-term local histories often overlook. Foreign relations is not just something that has happened out there, beyond current U.S. borders. Foreign relations have made these borders. And as histories of colonialism and empire have demonstrated, histories of foreign relations can be found here, in New Orleans, as well as in other places regarded by U.S. Americans as home. The lesson of such histories is clear. To understand the exercise of U.S. power, we need to consider inposts of empire as well as outposts. That is, we need to temper our tendency to understand the shape of U.S. power as a matter of exterior bases, colonies, carriers, compounds, client states, territories, and so forth, and to better flag how seemingly interior and domestic spaces have functioned in the production and exercise of power. Yet turning our gaze inward can do more than provide a broader base for stories about U.S. hegemony, superpower status, power projection, and overweening might. By recognizing that all outposts are inposts and vice versa depending on the point of view, we can better position U.S. history and global history, thereby bringing hitherto hidden stories to light. Labeling inposts in the United States as inposts of empire can help us understand the United States as an imperial formation, as well as a self-proclaimed nation, and to flag the role of empire in producing inequity and vulnerability from at least the time of the Shatter Zone onward. This move can help us understand the limits of U.S. power, the costs of empire, the geography of human insecurity, and the struggle to achieve collective security, even on a global scale, outside state-to-state relations of nations. Part 2, The Place Where It Happens. As scholarship on colonialism and empire has demonstrated, international relations histories, some of them histories of horrific violence, have played out across the present-day United States. Places such as Fallen Timbers, the Alamo, and Sand Creek may be labeled national historic landmarks and sites, but they are not just national sites. They are imperial battlegrounds and the crime scenes of colonial massacres. The seemingly national landscape of the United States is riddled with places that ought to be marked as loci of foreign relations, from the broken-windowed factories of the deindustrialized Midwest to the missile silos of the Great Plains, Superfund sites of the plutonium production complex, suburban drop sites of the CIA, classrooms of the School of the Americas, polyglot floors of packing plants, laden shelves of box stores into Amazon warehouses, footprint of the one-time Twin Towers, and quarantine stations of the CDC. It is not only in wartime that homes have been fronts. They have been sites of foreign relations encounter even in times of ostensible peace. Domesticity has had colonial, imperial, global, and other political dimensions well before hundreds of millions of anxious Americans sheltered in place to slow the spread of COVID-19. Historians have developed a broad conceptual vocabulary for thinking spatially about foreign relations history. Joining terms such as outposts in our toolkit for spatial analysis are terms such as middle grounds, native grounds, borderlands, frontiers, contact zones, enclaves, gateways, bases, entrepodes, nodes, rims, worlds, centers, peripheries, and ecosystems. There is a vast literature on global cities, much of it emphasizing capitalist development and control and the production of inequality, and a growing literature on the global countryside that pushes back against the urbanist assumption that cities should occupy privileged positions in our geographies of global interconnection. In parallel with the work of environmental historians, who have long recognized that everything is connected to everything else, historians of globalization have mapped links and webs, networks, chains, ebbs, flows, crossings, diasporas, mobilities, and transiness. This spatial analysis has made it clear that foreign relations unfold everywhere, that to better understand the history of the United States and the world, we must, paradoxically, widen our scope to encompass local history. Local histories with global dimensions can help us grasp this paradox. To be sure, not all local histories open out. There are plenty of local histories that start with assumed boundaries and direct attention relentlessly inward. Many local histories start and end small. At its best, this vein of local history can help us see the world in its fine grains. At its worst, this approach has drawn lines between insiders and outsiders, us and them, hiding the extent to which cross-border and other connections have shaped the fabric of daily life. Local histories have always afforded evidence of connection. In their references to newcomers, military service, mission endeavors, epidemics, native sons in national office, and the like. But foreign relations historians have had good reason not to loiter too long by the mustiest local history shelves in the library, for their antiquarian-leaning volumes seem a world away from the headier stuff of diplomacy, statecraft, and global affairs. These shelves deserve a second look, however, and not just because of current obstacles to visiting distant archives. In recent years, following the turn away from relentlessly national histories to more global, transnational, imperial, and trans-imperial approaches, local histories have increasingly opened out, stitching histories of specific places into the wider fabric of space. Rather than treating inter-indigenous relations, colonial violence, and other encounters as precursors to the real story, they have recognized these topics as central to our understanding of the past. Boundary-crossing local histories are contributing to wider efforts to debunk local global binaries by illuminating the dynamic relations and tension lines between these seeming poles. In addition to providing a vantage point for understanding globalization, unfettered local histories are grappling with a wide array of other foreign relations issues, stretching from migration to military capacity, production, consumption, trade, cultural exchanges, security, and sovereignty. Like the state and regional histories that they inform, they show the making of foreign policy publics and politics. In so doing, these histories contribute to the larger spatial turn in foreign relations history, advancing the effort to map different units, scales of analysis, and nodes. Just as significantly, these histories are also bringing the field of U.S. foreign relations history home to new audiences. Those most attuned to disparate power relationships are providing empirical grounding for theories of the local as subject to larger forces such as global capitalism, as well as for understandings of the local as a site of resistance to global capital and a wellspring for the exercise of power. Taken collectively, such studies are enabling us to comprehend seemingly domestic places such as New Orleans as inposts of empire. Part 3. Time Travel. Historians of the pre-Columbian and early modern eras have illuminated inter-Indigenous relations, Spanish and French exploration and colonialism, alliances between African-origin escapees from slave labor camps and Indigenous peoples, and the importance of New Orleans as a trading post linking the continental interior to the wider history of the Caribbean world, in turn embedded in the Atlantic world and global history. They have characterized the city as a diplomatic hub where representatives from the Alabama, Atacapa, Biloxi, Chittimacha, Choctaw, Creek, Nacogdoches, Opelousas, and Pascagoula nations negotiated with French officials. Historians have likewise brought to light the competition between the French, Spanish, and British empires to control the mouth of the Mississippi, the transfer of land taken from Atacapa Indians to Acadian refugees, the emergence of French resistance against Spanish rule, and cooperation across intercolonial lines to return self-liberated people to their putative owners. Recent scholarship has revealed how colonial incursions escalated warfare among indigenous nations, leading to a massive increase in captive taking as intertribal captivity became commercialized and French colonizers sold indigenous captives into lives of toil as enslaved workers on Caribbean plantations and Mediterranean galleys. They have reported scenes such as the 1682 description of a Changipa Hoa village. Carcasses of men and women, ruined huts, and others full of dead bodies, a coating of blood on the ground, and all their canoes broken and cut up with axes. Long before New Orleans came to seem foreign to East Coast and Midwestern visitors, Choctaws called this North American inpost a place of foreign languages. Many of the languages spoken in New Orleans were African languages. Enslaved people of African origin constituted a majority of the colony's population during the so-called French period. The rice that came to figure so prominently in the Louisiana economy came from Africa, as did the expertise and labor to cultivate it. Captive Senegambians sold into American slavery literally built southern ports, including New Orleans. The relentless demand for enslaved African workers in places such as Louisiana led to unfathomable violence an ocean away. In the Bight of Biafra, for example, escalating raiding and kidnapping fueled warfare among Igbo states. Moving into the Revolutionary Era and early years of U.S. independence, historians have brought life to the revolutionary ferment along the Gulf Coast and Spain's attempt to use its foothold on the Mississippi to claim territory stretching north to the Ohio River and east to the Appalachians. Historians have also explored the secret negotiations between Spain and France to swap Louisiana for an Italian principality, U.S. efforts to purchase New Orleans to ensure access to the mouth of the Mississippi, and the U.S. acquisition of all of Louisiana, or more accurately, the European recognized title to the same, thanks to revolutionaries in Haiti. Recent scholarship has illuminated the exodus of free people of color and white slaveholders from revolutionary Haiti to New Orleans. Some of these migrants obtained state and federal aid, but the enslaved workers forced to accompany them found no relief from their bondage. Inspired by the Haitian Revolution and French Declaration of the Rights of Man, more than 500 enslaved people rose up in Louisiana in 1811, hoping to establish their own state. The majority of these freedom seekers came from Congo, the Bight of Benin, and the Gold Coast. Some drew on military experience from fighting in Ghana and Angola. Subsequent chapters in the city's story focus on the 1815 Battle of New Orleans, during which U.S. forces and their Choctaw and French pirate allies crushed a British invasion. Historians of the antebellum era have stressed the entanglement of New Orleans in the fabric of Caribbean plantation society, including through the cross-border trafficking of enslaved people. Histories of this time have placed New Orleans at the center of the slave-holding empire of cotton. They have characterized this impost of empire as a polyglot, multiracial, multi-ethnic port city, ranked the fourth port in the world in 1849 after London, Liverpool, and New York. A place peppered with freight forwarders, commission houses, banks, and agents for both ships and cargo. The city was such a powerful commercial magnet in the antebellum era that it helped draw Tejanos away from Veracruz and Mexico City and towards affiliation with the United States. In the 1850s, the future president of Mexico, Benito Juarez, plotted against the dictatorial regime in Mexico from exile in the Crescent City. Antebellum Americans knew New Orleans as a launchpad for filibusters, as a place from which the pro-slavery DuBose Review issued its calls for Southern expansion. In 1851, rioters in the city attacked Spanish residents following news that Spanish authorities in Cuba had executed members of a filibustering expedition. As later digests of international law noted, the mob forced its way into the Spanish consulate and without any interruption or hindrance destroyed furniture, threw records into the street, defaced the portraits of the Queen of Spain and the Captain General of Cuba, and tore the flag of Spain into pieces, all without any interference on the part of the police. Confederate secession turned New Orleans into a point of strategic contention, its ruling class at war with the United States of America. After the U.S. Navy blockaded the city, General Benjamin F. Butler and his forces landed, turning it into a base from which to seize Confederate supplies and a testing ground for urban occupation methods. In New Orleans versus the Steamship Company, 1874, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that with respect to the powers of the military government over the city of New Orleans after its conquest, that it had the same power and rights in territory held by conquest as if the territory had belonged to a foreign country and had been subjugated in a foreign war. In the aftermath of the Civil War, New Orleans remained a place of encounter. Cuban revolutionaries such as Antonio Maceo and Maximo Gomez traveled to the city to network and raise funds from exiles. Wealthy Louisianians sought to recruit coolies from Cuba to toil in their cane fields. The Sicilians, who arrived in the late 19th century, established macaroni factories in the French Quarter. In 1891, the New Orleans political and commercial elite orchestrated the mass lynching of 11 Italians as part of a power play against the city's 30,000 ethnic Italian residents. The resulting diplomatic incident escalated into a war scare, leading the Secretary of War to strengthen harbor defenses. New Orleans' role as an imperial center extended beyond the days of pro-slavery empire building to the heyday of the Banana Empire. City boosters put their desire to enhance the city's role as a Caribbean gateway on full display in the 1884 Cotton Centennial Exposition. The construction of the Panama Canal further magnified the commercial elite's ambitions. The banana entrepreneurs of the early 20th century recruited from the city's waterfront bars, flophouses, and jails. Migrants from Honduras traveled in the opposite direction, establishing a Honduran foothold in the city that became more substantial over time. The Ukrainian immigrant turned banana baron, Samuel Zamuray, established the School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine at Tulane in 1912 to advance the United Fruit Company's corporate interests in Central America. As the city became a headquarters of U.S. formal and informal empire in the Caribbean and Central America, it also became a nodal point of Black nationalist resistance, including through the Pan-Africanist Garveyist movement. Such histories of connection, mobility, and the projection of power carried forward into the 20th century, as evidenced in histories of wartime. Homefront accounts of World War II report roundups of Japanese, German, and Italian enemy aliens, the visible presence of deploying sailors, soldiers, and Marines, a 25,000-man invasion of Audubon Park for training purposes, rampant prostitution, racist draft practices, and shortages. The World War II Museum, where we were slated to gather for the conference's opening event, originated as a museum dedicated to the city's Higgins Boat Works, credited by Eisenhower with winning the war by building the amphibious craft that landed U.S. troops in Normandy and on beaches across the Pacific. The Holocaust survivors who relocated to New Orleans after the war presaged later refugee and exile streams, with one major current emanating from war-torn Vietnam. NOLA deserves its fame as a nerve center in the continent-spanning history of jazz, the launch pad from which Satchmo blew up the world, a global destination for tourists, the embarkation point for thousands of cruise ships, and the home of a carnival float-making industry that caters to global markets. New Orleans' reputation as a party city owes a great deal to its Caribbean orientation. During Prohibition, it became known as one of the wettest spots in the United States, thanks to the legions of whiskeros and contrabandistas who smuggled in booze from Havana. Yet as a longer durée history of war, trade, diplomacy, occupation, and human trafficking suggests, to merely position the city in the context of pleasurable and commercial globality hides its long enmeshment in histories of empire. Some of these histories are literally marked on the walls of the city that contain signs noting the transfer from French to Spanish to U.S. rule. Tourist guides likewise register imperial histories and entries for the French Quarter, Cabildo, Jackson Square, and other attractions. Nevertheless, most of the history that I have just alluded to remains largely hidden. Tourist guides have long depicted NOLA as essentially foreign, likening sections of the Ninth Ward to, quote, the center of Africa, unquote, and describing the city as a whole as a Latin city, a foreign city, more northern Caribbean than southern U.S., charmingly European, a world in miniature, a place with a great confusion of tongues, and the least American of all the cities within the bounds of the American states. But these guides have done little to illuminate the histories of power. New Orleans has been far more embedded in empire than inscriptions, tourist guides, and museum displays acknowledge. Though seemingly a tourist-centered capital of pleasure, NOLA has long been an impost of empire from which force has radiated out. Part 4. Imperial Precarity. New Orleans has also been a place where imperialist politics have rendered residents vulnerable. To recognize NOLA as an imperial impost is to acknowledge crossing vectors of power, to reject false binaries such as acted versus acted upon, exporter versus importer, autonomous versus dependent, powerful versus hard-pressed. It is also to acknowledge multiple perspectives, for every outpost is simultaneously an impost to the people who regard that place as home. To label places like NOLA, imposts of empire, is to recognize that the colonial era did not end with the establishment of the United States, and to flag the role of imperialist politics in producing inequity and vulnerability. From the killing and enslavement of people of African and indigenous American descent to our own era, imperial systems have produced injustice at home as well as abroad. To take one timely example, we can see such injustice in the history of disease, starting with the epidemics of smallpox and other diseases spread through colonialism that have devastated indigenous people. Violence, hunger, overwork, displacement, and other forms of colonial duress have made virulent pathogens more deadly. The systems of capitalist accumulation developed by colonial powers have produced other festering health inequities. Yellow fever, the signal disease of New Orleans in the 18th and 19th centuries, did not exist in the Americas prior to European colonialism. The disease took hold in Louisiana because of the Atlantic trade in captured people, which also spread the disease in West Africa and the Caribbean, and the expansion of sugar production. From 1837 through the start of the Civil War, New Orleans took second place behind only New York as an entry point for immigrants, who, lacking immunity, became both victims and vectors. As the COVID-19 pandemic has made painfully evident, even to previously oblivious publics, systemic inequalities originating in the earliest days of European colonialism and racialized systems of enslavement have made some people, Native Americans and African Americans among them, far more vulnerable to border crossing epidemics than others. Even as President Trump denounced China for the cross-border spread of COVID-19, deportation flights embarking from Louisiana, the state with the second highest number of people in ICE detention facilities after Texas, were seeding Guatemala with the virus. Media accounts that alluded to the hard-hit city's role in spreading COVID-19 around the United States failed to grasp the extent to which this inpost of empire had become a vector of precarity. We can also see the imperial production of vulnerability in Hurricane Katrina, which devastated New Orleans in 2005. As with the present pandemic, long histories of systemic racism caused disparate outcomes. The storm disproportionately harmed African American residents in the lower income and elevation neighborhoods, especially the lower Ninth Ward. But it was not just the uneven impact of the storm that made it more than a natural disaster, it was also its magnitude. Our inability to work collectively to reduce carbon emissions is wreaking its alchemy in the Caribbean, where tropical storms are growing in force. Ironically, the oil and gas industries of the Gulf Coast that have literally fueled the U.S. assertion of global power have also exacerbated the threat that hurricanes pose to the Caribbean region, for the energy sector is the largest source of greenhouse gas emissions. The suffering caused by Katrina was more than an outcome of domestic injustices. It was also a manifestation of imperial blowback, the aerial precursor to the sloshback of the 2010 Deepwater Horizon oil spill that bumped Katrina down from its position on the list of worst oil spills in history. In the aftermath of Katrina, international news media broadcast horrific accounts of racialized poverty, abandonment, and suffering. One History of Katrina asserts that it exposed America's dirty laundry of poverty and race to the world in a way unseen since the civil rights era in the 1960s. Many U.S. observers likewise profess shock that the kinds of systemic breakdown associated with failed states could be found in the United States. Commentators began to refer to New Orleans as Third World and its evacuees as refugees, leading African-American community leaders to point out that the latter label was not applied to white residents who fled the city, and that the tendency to regard New Orleans as Third World revealed both domestic racism and misperceptions of the Global South. Horrified Americans made sense of the disaster through references to overseas military operations. As rapper B.J. Willis described the stricken city, "We wasn't in a war, but every day was a rock. Made you ride through my city in a boat, like a third world country that ain't got no hope." Many of the National Guard members deployed to New Orleans brought their experience in search and destroy missions in Afghanistan and Iraq to bear on search and rescue efforts, in some cases treating the beleaguered people of New Orleans as a menacing threat. The Army Times extended the talk of New Orleans as Baghdad South to another imperial reference point in its statement that combat operations are now underway on the streets. This place is going to look like Little Somalia. The Coast Guard drew a different parallel, labeling its evacuation plan Operation Dunkirk. The city planner appointed to head the post-storm reconstruction efforts also harkened back to World War II, saying, "I was too young to help resurrect Dresden or Berlin after the war, but that's what we're talking about here." Since neither Dresden nor Berlin had been destroyed by flood, this comment reveals the perception that only examples drawn from overseas military engagements could capture the magnitude of the disaster. When President Obama spoke in New Orleans a decade after Katrina, he echoed the common perception that it was somehow un-American for a nation capable of wreaking such damage to suffer it at home. "This was something that was supposed to never happen here," he said. "Maybe somewhere else, but not here, not in America." Calls for a Marshall Plan for the Gulf added to the sense that the damage was so un-American that a foreign aid plan was in order. The city did receive foreign aid, albeit on a selective basis. The wealthy residents of one gated community hired Israeli mercenaries as guards. The U.S. government accepted the assistance of Canadian Mounties and the Mexican military, but refused the aid offered by Fidel Castro and Hugo Chavez. When it turned to the task of rebuilding, the city sought advice from Dutch flood mitigation experts. Guatemalan and other Latino immigrants, many without documentation, performed much of the cleanup work at subpar wages, despite the dangerous, sewer-like condition of the city. Lines formed outside the Mexican consulate in the central business district as emergency workers sought services from their home government. Katrina flew in the face of understandings of the United States as the aid-providing superpower, the premier nation builder, the secure home referenced by Homeland Security. Katrina amplified post 9/11 sentiments of national vulnerability. Even as the George W. Bush administration charged U.S. occupation forces with bringing neoconservative enlightenment to Iraq, Katrina demonstrated the failure of the United States to meet basic needs at home. This was no coincidence. Members of the National Guard called to New Orleans complained that their best equipment was unavailable, having been shipped to the Gulf. The Persian Gulf, that is, not the Gulf of Mexico. Among those hardest hit by the storm in this inpost of empire, homeless veterans. Part 5, Local History as Vantage Point and Subject. I thought I would feel like an apostate in making a case to Schaefer for local history. But everyone who has been pinned to place in the last few months ought to get the significance of global affairs in producing locality. The ongoing pandemic serves as a reminder that even those who seek safety by walling themselves off from the world depend on collective community action, extending from our immediate face-to-face communities to state, federal, international, and global cooperative efforts. And everyone who is sheltered in place in hopes of breaking the chain of transmission understands that what we do locally can quickly radiate far beyond our own walls. A virus that can be seen only through microscopes has made globe-spanning chains of connection starkly visible. In 2016, Donald Trump ran and won on the vulnerability ticket. However rambling and incoherent, his campaign speeches were litanies of victimization. In his rally in New Orleans, candidate Trump denounced bad trade deals for destroying our country and asserted that we are not going to allow other countries to control us for any longer. Donald Trump lost the city but won the state, riding to office on the idea of vulnerable inposts dominated by powerful outside forces. His speeches can be seen as prime examples of imperial denial and their refusal to acknowledge the U.S. exercise of global power. Diplomatic historians have ample reason to be appalled at the misleading reality he has conjured. Born in 1946, candidate Trump had never known a time in which the United States had not exercised significant global power. Diplomatic historians need to continue to probe the deep sense of entitlement to power that Trump has tapped into and his success in positioning himself as the strongman who could restore U.S. preeminence. And yet diplomatic historians must also continue to probe the vulnerabilities that Trump maximized for political gain. This work has been picking up pace. After years of highlighting U.S. hegemony, unipolarity, and global imperial reach, foreign relations historians are increasingly charting post-Cold War declines in U.S. power and mapping the limits to U.S. power that have existed from the start. They have also taken a more critical look at blanket statements about U.S. power, advancing the point that the United States is more a quilt than a uniform cloth. By drawing on and contributing to scholarship that disaggregates the United States, dividing it into smaller parts by factors such as gender, race, class, ethnicity, religion, region, and generation, foreign relations historians have helped demonstrate that references to U.S. power have always hidden profound forms of disempowerment, even in the heart of empire. Local histories that are truly attentive to the multiplicity of experience in any one spot can advance this larger effort. As the history of New Orleans reveals, the deeper we drill into the heart of empire, the more precarity we find. All our attention to national security has made it easier to overlook not only the extent to which the U.S. security state has been an imperial security state, but also how people have experienced foreign relations in their daily lives, in small-scale, place-specific ways. Embracing local history as both an entry point into larger stories and as a subject of analysis can contribute to the larger effort to disaggregate the America, referenced by terms such as the United States of America, American foreign relations, and America first. It can help us understand that histories reflexively framed in transnational terms can hide more than trans-imperial crossings, connections, and hierarchies. They can also hide the translocal aspects of border crossing histories. Scaling down can help us better understand and recognize internal disparities and divisions, and to disentangle national security from other place-specific security concerns, such as the desire to hold the seas at bay. Scaling down to the local can also help us grasp the formation of foreign policy constituencies. As Joseph A. Fry has noted in an essay on regionalism, Place matters in how Americans have responded to and influenced the formation and implementation of U.S. foreign policy. Climate change denialism, for example, is becoming harder to reconcile with place-based experience, leading politicians from Gulf Coast communities to identify climate change as a threat. Feelings of insecurity are also leading to new forms of municipal foreign relations involvement that build upon older endeavors such as refugee resettlement programs, sanctuary provisions, sister city arrangements, mayoral trade missions, divestment policies, and the establishment of international relations offices within City Hall. Consider the report Climate Action for a Resilient New Orleans, published by the city in 2017. In the preface, Mayor Mitchell J. Landrieu spoke about the city's comprehensive resilience strategy launched in the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina to address urgent threats through combining local expertise with global best practices. Landrieu made the threat clear. If global temperature rises unchecked, New Orleans will not see another 300 years. In response to the threat, Landrieu called for adaptation and preventive action. It is not enough to plan for how we will adapt to climate change. We must end our contribution to it. Thus, some of the proposed steps, such as commitments to low-carbon electricity, a reduction in driving, and greener forms of tourism, be seen as an ineffectual move in the face of a global threat. The report noted that the agreement signed by 195 nations in Paris in December 2015 highlighted city action and that mayors representing more than 600 million constituents had participated in the deliberations. Along with claiming that local leadership is now more critical than ever, the report also called for global partnerships. Noted Landrieu, as the world committed to action in Paris in 2015, so too did we. I signed the Global Covenant of Mayors on Climate and Energy, adding New Orleans to the team of more than 7,400 cities in 119 countries worldwide committed to taking climate action. The report pointed out that New Orleans was already part of several intercity networks that provide opportunities for us to learn from other cities. New Orleans is joining a global movement. Further evidence of the border-crossing solidarities can be found in the Action Plan's acknowledgments, which thank chief resilience officers from Boulder, Colorado, Mexico City, Mexico, and Melbourne, Australia. As reports claim that cities must lead suggests, Landrieu framed the city's initiative as a rebuke to the federal government. The mayor affirmed that he, along with almost 300 other U.S. mayors, remain committed to the 2016 Paris Agreement, even after the Trump administration had rescinded the U.S. commitment. We must not waver, admonished Landrieu. We must work together. Time is of the essence in combating this critical existential threat, and our coastal city is on the front line. If the federal government would not protect its own inposts from a global threat, then NOLA would seek its own alliance partners. Such a move could be read as evidence of distrust in the capacity of the nation-to-nation system to provide for the city's security in the face of a global challenge. Or it could be read more radically as a vote of no confidence in the nation as the unit for assuring security, as evidence that the existential threats of the 21st century were exposing the kinds of internal geographic fractures associated with older systems of imperial rule. The New Orleans report noted one more way in which the city could advance human security. As a magnet for millions of visitors each year, it could do more to educate. In the past, we have effectively marketed our celebratory traditions of abundance, and we now have the opportunity to showcase the adaptability of our city and our embrace of a low-carbon future. We, too, can play a greater part in this educational effort. Going local provides a teaching opportunity, for it enables us to turn attachments to place into starting points for a wider and more critical understanding. Imagine the streets of New Orleans, or of any other place, if Schaefer members wrote the markers and signs. Whether in our scholarship, classrooms, or public engagement efforts, the more we can convey an understanding of foreign relations history as something proximate rather than distant, the more we can make our field seem immediate and relevant to audiences concerned about the here and now. And the more we can add the weight of history to present-minded analyses of global interconnections, the better we can counter the insularity seen, for example, in the assertion by the climate change-denying Louisiana Governor Bobby Jindal a decade after Katrina that the people of New Orleans have been able to go it alone to deliver hope and change for themselves. Where to begin in the face of such claims? With local histories that open out, labeling in posts of empire as such.